Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, to keep up with our most recent podcasts. We recently discussed Baby Driver, followed by The Thing and Prisoners, all separate podcasts. And next week, we'll be talking about Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch, two Guy Ritchie films, one podcast. I've also written a handful of things recently, most recently a piece about Annette Bening and Michael Douglas, as well as something about the way Jay-Z's new album has been reviewed and how big fish have their art reviewed once they have a sort of legacy. But yeah, let's get to another big fish and start talking about this movie.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James, clock is ticking.
I can't even believe you did the whole preamble.
Yeah, we really didn't have time for it, and yet I felt the need to indulge.
And we've been waiting so long for this.
Yeah, I mean, as we said in a conversation we were having with a friend of ours last weekend, we basically have this podcast so that we have an excuse to research new Christopher Nolan movies when they come out for way too long.
And it's here.
It is here.
And the moment has arrived.
We're recording to high quality tape because analog is the way to go.
All of our subscribing listeners will be mailed their 70 millimeter audio tape of this podcast.
Exactly. So Alistair, check your mailbox and nobody else.
No, Pete's excited too. But anyway.
Oh, okay.
Obviously we were talking about Dunkirk, Christopher Nolan's newest film. Which was much anticipated by us, much anticipated by a lot of people. Christopher Nolan's just at that point in his career where he's one of those directors that you will go see the movie of because you know that director's name. And that's not everybody, but he's definitely been in that rarefied air for a few movies now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it starts with The Dark Knight. I'm talking from a general populist sort of way, like by the time, I mean, I guess after Memento came out, it was sort of like I was on Team Nolan, and I'm sure you were as well. But basically, you know, say like your parents or the casual film fan, once The Dark Knight comes out, that's when Christopher Nolan becomes that sort of director, and Inception really basically doubled that, and to the point now where the star of Dunkirk is Christopher Nolan, you know? And
yeah, no one's saying they're gonna go see the new Finn Whitehead movie.
Yeah, exactly. And like Interstellar was also promoted very much as like Christopher Nolan as the star, but that movie also actually had like a real honest to God lead played by an honest to God movie star. So with this one, it's even more pronounced, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Despite the fact that there is a movie star in this movie in Tom Hardy, it's still like he gets the and credit. It's not like starring Tom Hardy. Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. This is a Christopher Nolan movie above anything else. And yeah. I mean, just the way that this movie is told through, you know, different stories and different timelines, and limited dialogue even within that, the actors and the characters really do kind of get pushed a little bit to the background. I think that there's you know, it's still not easy, and it's still important to have people who can act in this movie, but just the very nature of the way the story is told puts the movie in the spotlight more than the performers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so, I mean, where do you want to start? This is, you'd be the bigger Christopher Nolan fan on this podcast, so I feel like you can take the lead.
Oh, I mean, I don't even know. It's a very difficult movie to discuss because, I mean, this podcast might be 20 minutes or it might be 3 hours long. It's just, like, this movie's fantastic, you know? I very much enjoyed watching it. I texted my friend after because she had seen it the night before, and she was very, very curious to know my opinion. And I told her, like, There were a couple parts in this movie. The first time I saw it was in IMAX, and I'm fully in the tank for IMAX film, so I really appreciated that. And there were a couple times late in the movie, shots of Tom Hardy's airplane where, like, I remember, like, the physical feeling of feeling like I was kind of flying a little bit. And I think that is the benefit of such a giant screen, and also just the ratio, the aspect ratio of that screen. And I think that's really, really cool and impressive. And my arms were shaking after the movie was over. I said, and still maybe believe that it was because I was very caffeinated, but yeah, it was a fantastic experience. I really enjoyed it. I would be lying if I thought this is one of Christopher Nolan's best movies. I feel like, and again, this is, I'm going to say a lot of things that are kind of like backhanded compliments throughout this podcast, I feel like, because I feel like this is sort of like a the middle of the pack for Nolan as far as a movie, because when this movie ended, I went to get lunch, and I found myself not thinking about the movie so much as thinking about how it was made, whereas my favorite Christopher Nolan movies have been the ones that sort of reframe my own life and make me think about things in my day-to-day existence, whereas this movie, the thing that's the most that jumps out at you is the degree of difficulty to making the movie, because it's obviously such a difficult movie to make, because everybody knows, or anybody that does even the mildest amount of research knows that how much practical filmmaking goes into this movie. And I obviously find that very impressive. I just cannot imagine myself thinking about this movie 10 years from now the way that like Inception and Memento have been that way for me. You know, Inception's not 10 years old, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that. And do you feel that that's by design? I mean, I think that this is, I don't think it's trying to do that. You know what I mean? I don't find this to be intellectually engaging in a lot of ways. And I don't mean that to sound like the people in charge of making it are not intelligent people, because I don't think that's true. And I don't think that you have to be unintelligent to enjoy watching it, but this just seems so much more visceral than intellectual to me.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
I think that's clear, you know, even just reading about Christopher Nolan talking about what he wanted to do and how he says this isn't about where these people came from or, you know, who these characters are other than people in this incredible situation.
Yeah. No, I agree entirely. And he's been talking about doing stuff like sort of, I remember when The Dark Knight Rises came out, he was talking a lot about how he was really interested in silent films and trying to add sort of just a sense of sort of silent scale to The Dark Knight Rises. And I think part of that was, I mean, you probably remember the, I'm going to call it a non-controversy about The Dark Knight Rises prologue, where that was released before the movie came out and Bane's voice was more unintelligible than it ended up being in the picture. And so there was such a vocal outcry about it. And Nolan's response was, well, that's stupid. The words don't matter. I'm like, well, then don't have him talk. You know, like that was, yeah. That was just sort of a miscalculation on his part. But he had sort of been thinking about ways to make his storytelling less dialogue heavy, because I think everybody agrees that most of his movies are very hinge a lot on the dialogue, and I think a combination of The Dark Knight Rises and what he was trying to do and make sort of a silent war film, like you think of those scenes on Wall Street, those are the scenes where he's really was looking for those size, those scale moments, and combine that with sort of the grand scale storytelling that existed in Interstellar, and I think he tried to combine a couple of the things that he learned on those two movies into something that cut out all of the talking parts of Christopher Nolan movies and all of the, well, the city can fold in because of this that Ellen Page is telling us. So yeah, I do think that this is something that he had always wanted to do, and also to, by cutting out dialogue, he's able to shoot a lot more of it in IMAX as well, which is, I think, his goal for some time has been to make a movie entirely in IMAX. And I think this would be the, like, not have to do any shot not on IMAX film. I think this will be the closest he ever gets, because, like, unless he makes a full-on silent movie, it's just, it's because IMAX cameras are so loud, you can't really record dialogue without looping it. So there are some dialogue scenes in this movie that were shot on IMAX and they were all looped. But like any sort of important conversation, you can't really do with that giant camera making these giant sounds near Kenneth Branagh because it'll throw him off, you know?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that dialogue was never what people liked about Christopher Nolan anyway.
Well, I mean, the average person, I think that's why this movie has been so well received by people not like me, because I love all that dialogue in Nolan movies, you know? I love these twisty-turny stories that, I mean, The Prestige is a bunch of people talking, you know, and that movie's fantastic. It's an incredibly dialogue-heavy movie, and the twists are built around dialogue primarily, and narration, and I really enjoy that. But I agree that those are the things that, say, again, the casual filmgoer complains about, and this is a movie that removes that entirely, which I think has sort of led to it being elevated to a kind of person that might not enjoy the talkative Nolan style of movie the way that I do. Like, I like Interstellar way more than most people, you know, because it's a very talky Nolan movie, which is kind of my wheelhouse.
Yeah. Are you surprised that people are liking this as much as they are? Because it's still, I mean, you're absolutely correct that, you know, the dialogue being cut out makes it, I think, easier for some people to enjoy. And as I said, this one is just a lot more about feeling than, you know, anything intellectual. And I don't mean that, like, as I said, I don't think it's just dumb people who like this movie by any means. But it's so fundamental to people to, you know, experience the tension that this movie's, you know, being lauded so well, so often for conveying. Are you surprised that people are liking this as much as they are, or does that make sense to you?
I think it kind of makes sense. I think it mostly makes sense to me. I don't know. I guess I haven't really thought about it that much, just because I've kind of, as we talked about right off the top of our discussion here, people are just collectively, like, we all kind of agree Christopher Nolan is good, just like we all kind of agree that he can't write females, you know? Like, everybody, he's so famous as a director now that people just assume a movie that comes out directed by Christopher Nolan is going to be good, just like we assume that there's going to be a dead wife, even though this movie eliminates that by eliminating women almost entirely. But but that sort of thing, like, and just the talkative elements, like, I think the thing that allows this movie to be received by common people so strongly is that the removal of some of the things that people expect from Christopher Nolan movies that they don't like. And I think that elevates the feeling of the things about Christopher Nolan movies that people realize that they do like the timeline, playing with the timeline, and also the fact that that's not really a thing that would be done in a typical war movie, you know? So the surprises that exist in the war movie, or in Dunkirk, are muted compared to some of the other movies that Nolan has done, because Nolan's movies previously have typically been movies where you kind of expect stuff like that, or are at least, like, ready for it. I feel like most people going into Dunkirk aren't ready for the timeline thing, and so it's a nice little surprise that they then have to figure out. Whereas typically when you're going into a war movie, you sit down and you watch a movie that's fairly linear about war, and nothing really surprises you all that much, regardless of the quality of the movie. But this is something where the actual storytelling of it is done in a way that is very uncommon, if not unprecedented, for the genre. Yeah,
and it is so down the middle in so many ways. Like, it is so predictable. I just remember hearing that his next movie was going to be a World War II movie. You know, you like the some of the twists that come with it, with other movies he's made, or you know, wondering what's going to happen. And you know, we know World War II. And then the fact that it was Dunkirk is this specific story that we know. You know, it's not even like Saving Private Ryan, where we just took World War II and told this new story, this original story out of it. But, you know, just had the settings of Europe and, you know, Nazis and things like that. This is so, you know, just the subject matter and some of the things about it, the way it's being told, as I said, are just, you know, right down the middle, are pretty what you'd expect, other than the timeline jumping around. And even the fact that it's only 90 minutes, I think, is something that was throwing people off for a Christopher Nolan movie, especially because war films are often so epic, and because of the seriousness and the scale of World War II and just how important it is in shaping, you know, the world we live in up to this day, that it gets treated with this sometimes bloated, but at least just large sized movie. And I think that's something that surprised people too.
Yeah. And also, I mentioned this to you yesterday, but the fact that when you, again, you go into this movie and you have a set of expectations for a war movie, because it's not typically the most inventive genre. And what this movie is I was watching this director series video about The Dark Knight. That wasn't super interesting, to be honest. I watched 45 minutes of it. Didn't find it all that interesting. But like, there was one thing that I really enjoyed, where the narrator pointed out that was not a superhero movie made by Christopher Nolan. It was a Christopher Nolan movie about a superhero. And that is the something that I've been using to describe Dunkirk, is that it's not a war movie made by Christopher Nolan. It's a Christopher Nolan movie about war, you know, and just the timeline shifting and some, the way that he plays with what you would expect in this type of movie, and also doing that within the confines of reality. But there is no, like, for a war movie, usually you see some like active engagement and fighting back. There is almost none of that in this film. It's pretty much entirely Mark Rylance piloting a boat, or Finn Whitehead running away from things, you know, or trying to swim away from things. There's no, the closest thing we get to like soldiers on soldiers gunfight is at the very beginning, and immediately Finn Whitehead just runs away. And that's what we don't expect to see from a war movie, is that for the entire duration of it. We don't expect it to be long, we don't expect it to be as short as Dunkirk was. And just, I think the way that the movie was not about active engagement so much as trying to get out of a battle, I think that messed with people in a pleasing way. You know, it was this slight change from what they expected, and I think that goes a long way, more so than I think people might even realize. You know,
yeah, I mean from the to talk about deviations from war movie, and this is something Nolan has talked about, but it's a Hollywood war movie that doesn't show any Americans, so right away that's a big change. Mm-hmm. It's about a defeat. I mean, it's about a retreat, a withdrawal. And in Churchill's speech within this movie, and obviously in real life, they talk about this, you know, we're glad we were able to get this many people out, but this is still a defeat. You know, we can't win this war just by retreating really well over and over. there needs to be a way to do this that we actually gain ground. And those are more deviations that, oh, and as I said, just really, really never getting to know any characters. You know, we know their names, but there's no speech about back home. There's no speech about what Britain means to the world and the fundamental ideals and values of that country being the ones that the world should share and move forward with. So that's all very different. And, you know, when you talk about the beginning, you know, that opening scene of them walking through the streets in France, which I think is just a gorgeous shot to begin with.
Yeah, I saw it this afternoon again, and the guy behind me, like, the opening shot's just like, that's so beautiful. Which I agree with entirely. It's cropped weirdly in the version I saw today, like the 70 mil version, the non-IMAX version, which is a common theme in seeing the non-IMAX version. But like, that shot is still gorgeous, and just having papers flying around in the air, or the maps flying around in the air, it's just,
yeah, it's really nice. And then with the aspect ratio that you and I saw it in, it just looks like an old photograph too. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that the ratio used to be different in really old photographs, it's closer to square. And the colors are just beautiful. And then, you know, we see them just dealing with life as a soldier. You know, they're looking for cigarettes, they're looking for water, they're walking pretty casually. And you know, we get the shot from behind them, and then there's this really, I don't know, kind of perverse thing that happens, that it ends up that the viewer is the enemy. You know, we have the POV of the person or the people shooting at these soldiers. And I find that really jarring. I mean, obviously, just the very loud sounds of gunshots are jarring as well. And that we see these people, you know, the only people we've seen in this movie, most of them start dying very quickly. You know, that's obviously extremely jarring as well. But to have, you know, what looks like this beautiful European street and this well-composed shot, and then the immediate the sounds and the violence and what's depicted come so quickly and without warning, and just drops us right into the situation, just as the soldiers are dropped into it that quickly as well.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I'm curious to know what you feel about the movie as a whole.
Oh, are you?
Yes, I am.
I really liked it a lot. I was trying to avoid a lot of reviews and just a lot of things about it in the lead up to it. As I said, this isn't a movie that you can really spoil in a lot of ways, but I like having a clean slate going into a movie that I'm very excited about. And, you know, I saw a few things that I accidentally came across, a few reviews or heard some people talking about it, and just that talking about how it's just so tense, and just like anything, you know, not a Christopher Nolan movie, but anything that you've thought about so much before you get to experience it, you know, whether it's a, you know, an album or a book or, you know, anything that you know something about the author and you have a good chance that you're going to like it, but there's just that anticipation that this could be where they lose it or where they lose you, or it could be great. And just hearing those people talk about how tense it was, I was just in very like cinematic existential crisis of, you know, how tense can any movie be? Like, how good can any movie be? And like, that's just where I get with a movie like this that I just anticipate very highly. Mm-hmm. And I tried not to hype myself up too much for it, for the inevitable disappointment. And I will say, with very high hopes for this movie, I was not disappointed. I wouldn't say it is my favorite Christopher Nolan movie either, but I think it's really good. I think it's different, and I was happy that it's different. And as I said, those things that you do know about it going into it, and I knew that it would be a shorter movie, it not threw me off, but just got me very curious about how this is going to play out. And I think it's just a very self-contained movie. You know, I think that it is something you just experience in the theater. And I think you're right. I don't think there's going to be a lot of things that really shape my understanding of humanity. And I don't think that, like, the goal was to have you rethink anything. You know, yeah. I don't know what this movie says other than this was horrible and, you know, appreciate what veterans and the people who died in the war put up with and sacrificed.
Yeah.
And it's not even just that, man, isn't war horrible and senseless? I feel like Christopher Nolan's take on World War II would have been, the Nazis are terrible and we have to do whatever we can to stop them. You know, I just don't get any message from it. And I don't think I should. I don't think I have to. I don't think I honestly don't feel like I'm missing something. You know, there's some emotional things that work. I just think it's such a self-contained experience movie, and one that has done so well. And I think that's why we're not going to find a lot of people who dislike it, even though it is unusual in a lot of ways. It's just so effective. And I can't think of many emotionally affecting movies on this level, and that's why I'm not surprised that people are loving it as much as they are.
Mm-hmm. I do foresee a time when the people that didn't see it in a theater, it sort of ends up on Netflix or whatever, and people are watching it and saying, I don't get what the big deal is about. Like, yeah, you watched it on a computer. You know, like which I am certain will happen with a couple of people in my life, you know. And that's kind of a bummer, but also, I mean, this movie was designed in a way, like, I think this is, I think
the case for IMAX and 70 mil.
Sorry?
This movie is the case for IMAX and 70mm?
I mean, I think any footage that you have seen in IMAX is the case for IMAX and 70mm. Like, it doesn't matter. As long as somebody that knows how to use cameras is shooting in IMAX, it's just the most beautiful thing in the world, which is why I was pushing you on seeing this in IMAX with me so hard, even though we had to travel a little bit to get there. I'm so in the tank for it. And Interstellar was the first time when I knew enough about the visual image to really appreciate it. Like, I saw The Dark Knight Rises in IMAX once and thought it was fantastic, but Interstellar was really where I was, like, just blown away by it. And that is, again, the case for Dunkirk. But yeah, it just does... I am concerned about the inevitable time when I'm just like, well, if you saw it in the theater, you would have felt a lot better about it because it's a big, large movie, you know? And if you don't see it big, large, and hear it big and large, then it doesn't work because the sound is so important to this movie too, you know? I think the one thing that Nolan wants us to get out of this movie thematically is just sort of this, a belief in the goodness of the collective of humanity, I think. Even though the enemy, as the opening title cards say, is human, we don't see them, so they're sort of like almost not even personified in the film. We see like some guns pointing at Tom Hardy at one point, and I think that's about as much, and I think Harry Styles says German once, and other than that, they're always referred to as the enemy. Yeah, sorry.
And he says sauerkraut sauce.
Yeah, isn't that great?
No, it's not. Nolan has He's always got at least one absolute clunker in every one of his movies, and that's it for me in this one.
Oh, it's great. I was listening to an interview with him where he was talking about how he'd never done boats before. I'm like, I think James would agree that you've never done them properly, but not that you've never done them. The collective belief in humanity, which I think has been an interesting turn in the way that he has made movies. Like, I look at his career up until Inception, and as a collection of movies that are about much smaller narratives and deal with fewer people, whereas post-Inception, like with The Dark Knight Rises, Interstellar, and now Dunkirk being the best example of this, I feel like all of those movies are more about the collective over the individual and a sort of belief in humanity being able to conquer evil. And I found that to be a very interesting turn in his career, especially since all of the movies 2010 and previous make it feel like Nolan is such an internal person. And the fact that The Dark Knight Rises was even the sequel to two of those sort of internal movies, that I think the big victory of The Dark Knight Rises is that it is a movie about the great American, the great American man, that ends up being about the power of the collective, you know, and that, you know, the Batman became the symbol that inspired all of these other people. It didn't matter that Bruce Wayne was necessarily Batman. It just mattered that somebody was Batman to make other Batmans. And then Interstellar is about Coop is willing to travel all this way because he believes that humanity will catch up and be able to get him back by the time that he has finished his many years long journey. And this movie is Dunkirk is pretty obviously about that as well, because, you know, we have Mark Rylance and his boat is the representation of the civilians that came across to rescue soldiers. And this is the one where it really sort of hits you over the head with that, and the fact that there's no star for this movie, really. I just think all of that adds up to like an interesting shift in his filmography, and I think it must just be like a combination of getting older and seeing his kids get older that you could sort of see him sort of starting to think about the world in a different way, like I assume pretty much all parents do, you know. And I think that that's interesting.
Yeah, and I because I've just been looking at his career on the trajectory of scale, you know, with the following is so small. It's about a few people, but it's a small group of people. Memento is another one that it's a, you know, there's a star, but there's only a few other speaking parts, and it's about one person's, you know, journey, one person's mission to find somebody. And it gets bigger and bigger, and I think some of it is comfort with the art form. I think a lot of it is just budget. You know, the reason those movies are small is probably because they had to be small because of the amount of money. And then I remember Inception, you know, there's the different worlds, but they're all still inside people. And then Interstellar, you know, let's talk about scale. It takes place over this incredible amount of time, this incredible amount of geographical distance. And I was just wondering how to continue this trend upward, you know, so we've literally gone Interstellar. I mean, other than the multiverse exploration, you know, what is there to get bigger than this? Yeah. And I think that, you know, he's obviously maxed out, so he has to start thinking of it in a different way. And it seems like Dunkirk is kind of an outlier in a way out of that problem. But I think you're correct that it is just about, it's about humanity as a whole. And I think that casting these people who are so young and inexperienced and, you know, not really famous yet plays into that as well. And that it's just, we don't even need famous actors, you know, we just need actors, you know, they didn't need destroyers. They just needed boats. And just this idea that everybody has something to offer, and only by combining all those forces are we ever going to be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this movie has a very hilarious three with credits. Like, anybody that I think it's Kenneth Branagh, I don't know the order, Cillian Murphy and Mark Rylance all get withs, and Tom Hardy gets to have the hammer and brings in the and credit. But those are all people that have been the stars of movies. One of them's an Oscar winner, and you know, could be promoted as a star of a movie, I guess, to a certain kind of audience. You know, like Tom Hardy could be the star of a movie of this scale, but the other three, it would have to be I guess Kenneth Branagh's the star of Murder on the Orient Express. Anyway, but that idea that it's not starring Kenneth Branagh and these people, it's just Finn Whitehead, who is somebody nobody has seen in a movie before, is the lead. And
on the poster, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think everybody would agree is the lead character, just because we spend the most time with him and the last shot of the movie.
First and last, he's in them, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But depending on who you believe, or if you believe Christopher Nolan, he didn't even know who Harry Styles was, which I half believe, but also don't believe nobody told him who Harry Styles was. Yeah. Like, there are so many people in his life that must both know who Harry Styles is and know that Christopher Nolan doesn't give a fuck about who Harry Styles is. So somebody,
it does make him cooler, right?
That he doesn't know anything about One Direction?
Yeah, if he honestly didn't know.
Oh, if he honestly didn't know, that would be fantastic. But I think there's a history of Nolan saying things that I just straight up don't believe. and I think this is one of them. And also, I think he's so good at understanding how his movies can be marketed in a way that sort of keeps him looking cool and also makes the movie appealing to others, that he would be the type of person that would understand that if Harry Styles can pull his own weight in this movie, which I think he does. I don't know. It would be helpful for him to have him there. Like, I think another example is Memento is very similar to Nicholas Roeg's, I might be pronouncing that improperly, it's R-O-E-G, Don't Look Back with Donald Sutherland. And Nolan at the time claimed to have never seen that movie, and I just don't believe that for a second, you know? And so I feel like there are other examples, but I think other than The Dark Knight and him constantly saying, I'm remaking Heat when The Dark Knight was coming out, I think he's always sort of tried to obscure something about his movies, but yeah. But whatever. He's a cool dude. I'll let it go.
Yeah. You mentioned the Germans. Sorry, the enemy.
The enemy.
not being shown too much. And this reminded me of something, you know, especially contrasting it to other war movies and criticisms that a lot of people have made, including myself, about certain war movies and about them functioning as propaganda, you know, something like Top Gun, you know, one that makes the war or you know, the military, the armed forces to be cool, you know, to be, you know, sexy and fun and interesting and
charismatic, to be Tom Cruise in the 80s, basically.
yeah, and to be like a thrilling kind of dangerous, but not like a truly life-threatening kind of danger. And that's a couple ways that I think those movies do that kind of more exploitative thing is by making the enemy sort of a nobody, you know, not giving them a name or a backstory, maybe not even seeing their face like you barely do in Top Gun. And to not really making it gory, as I said, you know, not to make things, you know, to make it kind of threatening, but not truly horrific and dangerous. And this movie is not gory at all. I mean, there's some very unpleasant parts, but it's, as far as blood, it's very, very rare to see any of it on screen.
I mean, the only time I can think about it is when I forget the kid who dies on the boat, on Mr. Dawson's boat, but like from the back of his head, there's a little bit of blood. And even in that situation, for him to die that quickly, there would have been so much more blood, you know?
Yeah. And a little bit on the guy they carry on the stretcher, but he's not even like actively bleeding. There's just blood. But it's extremely minimal. The fact that this is a war movie where, you know, 70,000 people die from the beginning to the end, and we're having a hard time coming up with examples of blood. And to even the soldiers that we like, you know, even our guys, the guys on the side of the war that we are cheering for, we don't know much of their story. You know, we don't really care about them as people. We don't care about that backstory. And I think that that's something we would criticize any action movie for, you know. Oh, I didn't even know his name. You know, I could see that being a criticism that we would make about a movie that didn't emotionally impact us. So why is this, like, not even just not a problem, but kind of celebrated in this movie? These things that I think would be extremely common criticisms of movies not only being overlooked, but people pointing out as a reason why this movie is good. What's the difference?
I think it's because even without those things, the movie is able to make you feel something. Like I mentioned at the beginning, whether or not it was caffeine or the movie, my arms were shaking when this movie was over. And I have found that the people that I have talked to that have seen this movie have sort of come out of it, rattled is too strong, but sort of like feeling something, you know, feeling like they have been through an intense movie going experience. And I think that that has been pretty common across the board, that the intensity of the movie really does carry over to the viewers. And I think the fact that people are able to feel something like that while sitting in a movie theater chair sort of allows them to forgive some of these things that maybe would bother them in a movie that's not this same movie made by somebody that's not as good at making such visceral films, you know. And I feel like that since people are able to feel some sort of representation of the intensity that I mean, like the tiniest percentage of the intensity that actually existed in a real life threatening situation and a horrifying situation, I think that is able to sort of cover up and be more affecting than intestines hanging out ever could be. You know, like I don't need to see somebody bleeding when they're being crushed by a giant boat. Their screams and the sound of the wood that the boat is crushing them on is enough. You know, just like the hand reaching out of the French guy who's trapped in chains is horrifying too. You know, like bloodless deaths can be very horrifying too, and I think the overall feeling of the movie sort of covers up a certain lack of things, just because the movie does such a good job conveying the feeling of intensity.
Yeah, because I guess that can swing the other way too, right? It seems when things are too gory, it's just shock value, or it's exploitative, and you're doing these things because you aren't able to communicate what you want to communicate without kind of stooping to that level, right?
Exactly. Like, so, I mean, I say intestines hanging out because that's the only thing I remember about Saving Private Ryan. Other than that, and Ted Danson showing up in the middle for some reason.
and Vin Diesel being in it.
Oh, yeah.
Don't let the world forget Vin Diesel was in Saving Private Ryan.
Or that his short film was called Multifacial. and that's what Steven Spielberg loved and cast him in, or cast him for. But, yeah, and I just feel like again, it's something that Nolan is able to, I think Nolan like really likes movies, even though he says he doesn't watch movies while he's making movies, which I do believe. I feel like he is the type of person that spent a lot of time in like his basement growing up watching movies. He doesn't talk about it like Quentin Tarantino does, but I do get the feeling that he does actively really like watching movies and still does. And I think he's seen enough of these movies. And I think what he tries to do with his movies pretty across the board is think of movies that his movies are like, because it's, I mean, looking at the genres of his movies, none of them are all that original, you know? And what he does is sort of take something that we already know, take the cutout that we already know and sort of bend it in a sort of way that we haven't seen before. And I think he takes out the things, he's able to feel the things that annoy other people or some other people, or the things that he feels like don't work, and sort of just change them a little bit, you know? And I just think that that's this, the thing that carries through Nolan's whole career is this sort of understanding what people think this thing means and sort of saying it in a slightly different way. Like there's that line in Interstellar where Cooper's explaining why his kid's named Murphy, and she says something like, why did you name me after a law that's whatever can go wrong will go wrong? And Matthew McConaughey says something along the lines of whatever can happen will happen, which is kind of the same thing with just different words, you know? And I think that that discussion is totally indicative of how Christopher Nolan makes movies. He sees how people have commonly accepted these things and changes them just a little bit, but not so much that we fall off board. Yeah.
And I just think that the,
and also just from a purely action standpoint, he just knows how to make big action sequences.
I just don't think that the deaths in these, you know, they are unpleasant. As you said, the guy being crushed or people burning and people drowning, which must be a pretty awful way to go as well.
And the guy getting bombed off the beach is the one I remember the most. Like that shot is unbelievable.
Oh, where like, Thomas just got his head down?
Yeah, exactly. He's cover, duck and cover.
Yeah, and to me, I just don't think that, as I said, you know, the message isn't war is so so gory and so grotesque. I think it's just, as I said, the tension. I think that's what's supposed to be communicated here. These deaths aren't to show how bad it can be to die. They're the reminder of what these people are fearing at all times, and I think it's I think it's the fear that people are experiencing that people are reacting to. And I think that's the feeling that everybody's getting so well. And that's what's coming across. And that's why people are liking it. Just the fear, you know, just if we just go by the soundtrack alone, just the nonstop tension. Do you know about the shepherd sounds? Do you know what that is?
No.
Okay, it's this way that they do it in this movie. It's a way to sort of construct musical notes, so it sounds like they're always getting higher and higher, is unpleasant for humans to listen to, but it never gets to that screeching sound just by the way that the different sounds within the one note are, the volume changes on them. It's pretty interesting, but I think that's what it is. I think it's the constant fear of death and not the unpleasantness of death that gets across here. And I know those things are obviously extremely related, but it's the struggle to survive more than the very notion of death that I think this movie is so focused on, and why I think everyone can relate to it, because no one seeing this movie has died, but everyone seeing this movie has feared death. Now, not been in this situation, but just as humans watching other humans, even in a fictional setting, try to withstand that, I think is how people are being affected so deeply by this.
Yeah, and I think part of what helps that is Nolan's
Hans Zimmer.
Well, also Hans Zimmer, obviously.
Nolan's pocket watch.
I'm half upset that Hans Zimmer's on tour because hasn't been doing any promotion for Dunkirk, whereas like for Interstellar he was doing a bunch, and I feel like he would have done some for this movie if he hadn't been touring, but yeah, Hans is the best, obviously. But I think one thing that sort of helps keep that feeling of what was it called, shepherd sound?
Yeah,
something that helps keep that is that we often talk about things in movies that we like that jump out at us as terrible. And I think an example of this for you is the sauerkraut sauce line in this movie. But but that's not the type of thing. That's an example of Nolan's version of that. Because what Nolan doesn't have is these CGI snap zooms that bring you out of a movie. Or yes. Something that is obviously a digital effect. And you're not thinking about, oh, this is cool for the story. You're thinking, oh, this is cool that they did this. You know, like even War of Planet of the Apes, which is a movie that came out recently, that's a good movie. I can't help but think, wow, this is impressive so frequently. And I just want to be I don't really want to think about computers when I'm watching a movie about a Woody Harrelson fighting a bunch of apes, you know? I want to be thinking about Woody Harrelson fighting apes. But it's just, as impressive as that effect might be, you can't help but think about how impressive it is. Whereas with this movie, the fact that so much of it is done practically, and I think I would read, if you sent me 1,000 pages of things, if you sent me an infinite jest length book about the Spitfire scenes in this movie, I would read the whole thing tomorrow. You know, like I would manipulate time like Christopher Nolan does so frequently, so that I could read 1,000 page book in a day. And it's just so fascinating to me how they, I'll briefly explain it, that they, for a lot of the scenes, they had a plane with like a double cockpit so that they could have the actor actually flying around so that Tom Hardy can do his close-ups while he's in a plane flying around. And I know there was also a gimbal that they would have on the beach as well, but I just, that's so bonkers. And we talked about it with Baby Driver, but Baby Driver is another example where they didn't want to do green screen driving shots because it looks so fake, because it does look so fake, and it always removes something from the movie. Or from your feeling that you get from the movie. And I think just Nolan's dedication to not wanting to take you out of, the film capturing of real life, I think helps keep that intensity going. You know, there's just nothing that pulls you out of it. And I think that just sort of keeps you in it. And when you see something truly impressive, and I think this movie's most impressive images mostly come towards the end, I think that sort of even makes the feeling more powerful, you know, like the shot of that in the oil scene when the ship tips over. The second time I saw it, not even the first time, like the second time I saw it, I remember saying Jesus Christ out loud. Like, I have no idea how they did that. They can't possibly have actually tipped over a ship. That doesn't make any sense to me. But it just looked amazing. And all of the Spitfire shots, when that plane crashes and the camera's attached to the plane as it hits the water. Yeah. It's so bonkers. And that shot of Tom Hardy flying across, when he's out of fuel and he's flying, and you've got the city of Dunkirk in the background, is like borderline breathtaking. And
yeah, and the propeller not moving or barely moving.
Oh god! And so you don't have to hear the sounds of the plane that you've been hearing in every one of his scenes to this point. And also when the ship tips over, the camera's attached to the ship, and people being like the water just drowning them / crushing them. Those shots are just beyond outstanding, you know. And I just sort of feel like that there is nothing in those shots that takes you out of it as something that's clearly fake, allows this Shepherd sound effect to continue to work throughout the film. Yeah. Because you're never, I mean, obviously somebody like me, I'm thinking about, holy shit, that camera's attached to that ship and the water's actually pushing these people into the ship and all this stuff. But you know, if you're able to really let yourself go and remove yourself from filmmaking technology a little bit, you don't have to go far to sort of really be sucked in by this movie.
Yeah. So when you talk about Tom Hardy's partner going down, that splash landing in the water, I think is one of the ones I think about where I don't know how they would have done that other than doing it.
Yeah. They did that. And then,
you know, and then we get away from him and we move to a different part of the story and we only come back to that landing later. What do we gain with the time being played with in this one? I mean, it's integral to Inception and Interstellar. It's spelt out and, you know, extremely important to there, the idea of time dilation. What do we gain not telling the story straightforward?
I sort of feel like the way that it felt to me is that, or at least the, what I was thinking about after while I was eating my lunch, was that the way that Nolan would have had it in his mind is that there would have been periods of the week of the mole storyline where nothing all that interesting is happening, where they're just lying on the beach, you know? And those are the things you would probably forget amidst all of, like, as time passes, these survivors, if they live through the war and continue their lives, like, those are the things they would end up forgetting, are all of those in-between things. Their memories of Dunkirk would be all of the horrifying things that we see, you know, all of the escapes from the ship and all these various things. And just like the Mr. Dawson and everybody on the boat, that day would feel like it took forever, just like an hour up in the air would feel like it took forever, you know? And I think that what Nolan's trying to get across with that is just a combination of memory and the way that things that are so intense feel, that you forget about all of the stuff in between. And since we have so little actual time, I mean, the Tom Hardy storyline is technically shorter than this actual movie. And I think but every minute of that hour would be memorable to Tom Hardy, you know, Tom Hardy's character, just because of the situation he's in. He's under constant threat just because he's in the air and he's not very high up, as they discuss briefly in the movie. I just think every moment of that hour would be so stressful that you couldn't possibly forget it. Whereas just by the nature of the way the human brain works, you're not going to remember every moment from a week, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I like how we, you know, when we leave certain characters and we come back to them, just the idea of what life is like when you're not in it anymore. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're all the center of our own narrative, but that's, you know, we can't all be the middle of the universe, so other people go off and live different ways. And I still enjoy when, you know, the two pilots, Tom Hardy thinks he's being waved at, kind of a wave goodbye, sort of a good luck wave, and it's really someone fighting for their life, someone trying to get out of a plane that's about to sink. And when it's out of his the field of vision, there's this whole other story, and we see you know, Mark Rylance's boat and the kid trying to save him, and how different someone's experience can look like when you're no longer a focus of it.
Yeah, and I think the best way, like, it actually made me like kind of chuckle a little bit, is when, after we've seen a little bit with Cillian Murphy on Mr. Dawson's boat, when he shows up on that boat at the night pre the U-boat attack that ends up getting him on Mr. Dawson's boat. Like when I saw Cillian Murphy, I just chuckled. I was like, oh, Nolan, you goof. You know? And
and he's telling people how they can just stay in the water and it's not that big of a deal. And
yeah,
just, you know, 20, 30 minutes before, he's trying to commandeer someone else's boat who's on their way to save his comrades, but you know, looking, he's literally hitting children downstairs in order to assuage his fear and get back home as soon as he can.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think the timeline stuff is for narrative purposes is always super clean. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to do, so I mean, nailing it more often than not is pretty impressive. But you know, I seem to have slightly, I think it was more done just to make the action more intense, you know. I think that was the number one reason behind it, because he wanted to have all three of these action sequences converge eventually for the climax. Yeah. Of his movie. I think that's the real reason why he played with the timeline. Well, that combined with he doesn't know how to make a movie where he doesn't play with the timeline, because I assume there would be some manipulation of time in this movie. I didn't predict the way that it was, but when I saw the mole one week, I was like, okay, I don't quite know what that means. When I saw the sea one day, I was like, oh, I get it. Nolan, you goof. And then everybody around me shushed me for saying Nolan, you goof. But yeah, I don't think it works perfectly, but I think that it works more often than it doesn't is like unbelievable. You know, like the degree of difficulty on that is so high.
Yeah.
And just the level of confidence you have to have in yourself to pull that off. It's amazing.
Yeah. I think he's a pretty confident person.
Yeah, so do I. But I don't know, just sort of this quiet British dude. There's not a huge... I feel like when you watch him talk, you can tell he's both confident, but also he doesn't seem like an extremely confident person. But he has to be an extremely confident person to make this movie, you know?
Yeah.
Because in the pre-production meetings, when you were describing this movie and how you want to make this movie, there are a million people saying, you can't make it this way. You know, like, it's just bonkers.
Who's the star? A bunch of not famous people.
How are you going to shoot it? Handheld with IMAX cameras. Okay, so we'll CGI these boats. No, we'll sink them for real. All right, well, how are we going to do the dogfight planes? We attach IMAX cameras to planes. Tom Hardy's in the plane, and a stuntman's piloting it from a second cockpit. Like, all of these things are bonkers, you know? And he did all of them.
So, are you confident in some Oscar love?
I think Best Director is his to lose. I think this is sort of like the Revenant situation, where anybody that sees this movie knows it was very difficult to make, or it can at least feel that it probably was. And so much of the discussion of, or the publicizing of the movie is about the filmmaking side of things, and how everything's done for real, and we shot in large format cameras, and all of these things that I love hearing, and can't get enough of it. But all of these things that, again, Christopher Nolan is the star of this movie, and I unless there is some sort of like enough time passing that people get tired of the Christopher Nolan love fest by the time the Oscars come out, or there's like some surprise amazing, like PTA does something unbelievable with Phantom Thread, which I mean he makes movies that are too weird to give Oscars to, so that would surprise me. But as of today I think it's Nolan's award to lose, you know. And there's no way he doesn't get a nomination. There's just no way.
Right. And maybe he'll get a Best Director win before we have to give him like a Best Director win down the road for something that's less deserving.
yeah. He still hasn't made a shitty movie though. I'm curious to know how you feel about you know, you probably saw an IMAX film as a kid. I know I did, but on various field trips and whatnot to science centers. But I would imagine this is the first time as an adult that you watched a movie shot on IMAX, projected on an IMAX film, and I'm just curious to know what you felt about the experience.
I got struck by it right away, so that's positive. You know, it's hard to separate just the composition of a frame from the experience of seeing it there, because I did see it a second time and was not nearly taken aback by it as I was during IMAX. Now I knew exactly what was coming with that first image, so that could contribute to it too. And so I think I did it in the opposite direction if I really want to appreciate IMAX, I think, the most. But I think I appreciated it a lot the first time. And it was nice that my first time seeing this movie with a movie that I was very much looking forward to, it seeing it in, you know, ideal conditions, I think is something I'm very happy about. And it's tough for me to separate it from the movie, mm-hmm. but I thought it looked great. I thought it sounded great. And I mean, we talked about the music and the sound in this movie, but I think the sound design's amazing. And I think that's another Oscar nomination right there, because I think this, as constant as some of the music is, some of the spaces between sounds and then how sharp those sounds are, I think is another thing that makes this movie so great. And I think about that opening sequence or the scene on the boat and, on the boat. That's not very specific for Dunkirk. The scene where they're hiding in the hull of the boat waiting for the tide to come in with the Scottish Highlanders. I think that really, really good sound elevates those scenes so much. I think that this movie absolutely brought that, and that seemed more clear to me in the first time seeing it in IMAX than elsewhere.
Well, and also IMAX is like borderline too loud, so that's part of it, and I think that sort of helps really add to the scope of the movie and the level of terror, and also
kind
of help shut up the people that are talking behind you, which is a nice, which is nice. I obviously love it. I don't have anything new to say about it. I just think it's fantastic. I understand why nobody else does it, because everything that I know about filmmaking and what you have to adjust to do this stuff on IMAX just seems so difficult that I totally understand people not wanting to attempt it. But I'm so happy one person does, you know, and I would be very happy if other people did. Something I'm curious to know is, because I feel like the way that people talk about this movie a lot of times centers around the format that they see it in. I was watching this Q&A with Nolan, I think at the Lincoln Film Center, where the first question was, tell us about IMAX film. And they hadn't even been watching, the screening wasn't even on IMAX film, you know, it was just on regular 70 mil. And before even talking about the movie itself, they were talking about the making of the film. And that's something that I sort of, I have mild qualms about, despite the fact that I love all of that stuff. I'm just, I don't know. I guess I feel slightly uneasy about the fact that with a movie that is very good, albeit not my favorite movie, I'm just curious to know, or I guess a little concerned with, say, Nolan's next movie is something that I love on the level of Inception or Memento. Are we going to be talking about IMAX first, you know? And that concerns me a little bit, I guess, is that despite the fact that Nolan cares so much about doing things for real and doing things with his analog technology and his special effects analog, or real world effects, I'm just wondering if maybe that has sort of crossed a threshold of just becoming too much. Like, we're just talking about it too much. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that there might be different motivations for different people to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes people might want to be the smartest person in the room and just to prove that they know about the process, or about that this is the way he wanted to show it.
You can make it clear that you were talking about me, but
so hipster douchebag.
I will say that the first time I saw this movie, the people behind me before the movie were having a discussion about aspect ratios. So I am not the only nerd out there. Anyway,
continue. No, not by no means are you. And I think that the motivations kind of are all over the place. I think, you know, part of it is wanting to know everything you can about it. In a good way. I think that functions in a positive way as well, you know, just embracing this movie, embracing this filmmaker and the manner in which he wants to tell it. I think that sometimes there can be a form of conspicuous consumption as well, you know, to be seen knowing this, or to be seen going mm-hmm. to the highest level format, however you want to phrase that, of something that everyone's going to see, right? The mm-hmm. fact that you're going to the more expensive, more exclusive one. You know, I think about people with vinyl. I think that there's tons of good reasons to listen to music on vinyl. And I think part of that is to consume the art the way the artist intended you to consume it. I think that there's something fine with that. And I think some people can take it too far and want to be seen doing that, more importantly than just enjoying it themselves. And that it's something of a status symbol. And I think that kind of hand in hand with that, and I don't mean to make this all sound so negative, is that to position yourself as someone who is interested in the inconvenient way. You know, the reason people are switching to film projectors is because it's a lot simpler. You know, it's a lot simpler for the people.
You mean digital projectors?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I don't know what I said. yeah, it's just more convenient and it's more cost effective. And for you as a consumer to spend more money to go out of your way, you know, it's showing you're willing to inconvenience yourself or pay more money to see this thing that the way you know, the creator, as I said, kind of intended you to see it.
The creator. I love it.
There you go. Sure. I won't correct my meaning of that. And yeah, I think as digital technology takes over, you know, it's in a way, and I know this isn't how your heart feels, it's so absurd to ship out colored strips of film and project them onto a wall when, you know, everything else is just done with ones and zeros and pixels and things like that. And as I said, I really enjoyed seeing it that way too. So I'm not trying to put myself above anything, but I think that there's just a wide variety of reasons why this is at the forefront of this discussion. And I think that, doing it the way that the people who made it want you to see it is fine. You know, that it's good. It's fantastic. You know, if you think that if you were ever creating some kind of art or anything worth a public exhibition, that people would want to do it the way that you do it. So people, you know, maybe some of these film writers want to show that they know about this. And that's why it's the first question, is because they know that this is important to Christopher Nolan, and maybe they want to endear themselves a little to him, or they want to sound like they've done their research. I think I'm less, is negative, I kind of made a lot of that sound. I think I'm less concerned about the fact that people are talking about it this much. And I think that I've listened to enough people's music played from their shitty phone speaker that I'm so much more willing to hear people talk about fidelity of sound and to talk about aspect ratio, even if I get annoyed by it once in a while, if it means that we're doing ourselves the favor of watching things properly.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
What's your concern about it?
Is I don't know. I just
into the background.
Sorry.
Your concern is that it's just pushing the quality of the movie into the background.
Yeah, exactly. Like, again, Memento and Inception are the two that always come to mind. The Dark Knight would be third as well. Just as movies that I thought were just like, I mean, Memento, again, I feel like I've said this on a pod. Sure, I mean, we've done a podcast on Memento, so I must have said it. It reframed how I think about reality, I think, and has influenced like my day-to-day existence, because I saw that movie at a young enough age and remain obsessed with memory 16 years later, 17 years later. And so I think, and the fact that I saw that on a VHS copy in my parents' basement, you know, like, fidelity didn't matter. I also didn't know anything about fidelity at the time. I didn't know anything about aspect ratios at the time. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been watching it on a VHS pan and scan version. And, you know, and then the most powerful emotional response to a movie I've ever had was when I saw Inception. Inception, since Christopher Nolan started shooting on IMAX, Inception's the only one that he hasn't shot anything in IMAX, any sequence in IMAX. And so I guess my concern is just that that for something I am so interested in and care so much about, it doesn't really matter. You know, like if the movie is good enough, I will still be like broken into pieces by it. And it's just like, the really hard thing is not to make it big and beautiful and super visceral. The really difficult thing is to make this constructed story, this whole story that ends up, I don't know, making me have very weird phone conversations for 30 minutes after I'm trying to put my brain back together after seeing Inception, you know? And yeah. So like, let's say, who knows what Nolan's going to do next? I don't think it's going to be a Dunkirk extended cinematic universe, but you know, if the next thing is like something like Inception, I want to be able to talk about the feelings as opposed to the size of the film strip, you know, or that it was horizontally projected, which is also very cool. And I feel like I have to mention slightly undercutting my point, but
yeah, no, I think that's, I can get behind all of that. And I think that that's true. And I think that, Nolan is also more concerned with telling a story than utilizing the best technology. You know, I think of him as a different person than a different filmmaker than James Cameron in that aspect, and almost every other aspect. But I don't think he's that kind of guy. But I think with this movie in particular, it is so much about that. I think that it's this very human connection of putting yourself in someone's position. I think that Inception, Interstellar, a lot of other Nolan movies are about thinking about that story, but I think this one is more about experiencing it. And I think a lot of people would still write and talk about any movie he does in 70 mil in IMAX and talking about 70 mil in IMAX, because it's just a part of the story and it's a way into your, whatever your piece about it. But I think that this is just such a story to be experienced and not to be shown and to be thought about. And I know that sounds kind of pejorative, but I think it is just this very, as you said, visceral, very in the moment kind of movie to experience. And I think that, you know, now with American politics the way it is, I think that so many things that don't warrant it are being kind of reviewed and connected to Trump and to American politics. And a few people are trying to do it with Dunkirk, but it's so clunky. I think that it's one of the successes of this movie is that it's so self-contained. And, you know, I think you're right. This isn't the beginning of a cinematic universe. This isn't commenting on anything else. This is exactly what you see on the screen. And that's why I think the way that you see it on the screen and, you know, just the film stock, the IMAX, that kind of thing is so important, because this isn't a movie for your brain. You know, it's, again, I don't mean that to sound too bad either. This isn't a movie for your brain. It's a movie for your gut. It's a little bit of a movie for your heart, but for the most part, it's for your gut. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an absolute success at that. And I think that's why people are responding to it. That's why people are talking about it that way. And I think that's why people are probably going to continue to like it. I agree that watching it on your laptop won't give you the same effect, but I think that there's so much about the way that this movie is put together and all summed up within those 90 minutes that I think it's going to be doing well for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And also the way that Nolan makes movies, the sort of practical way, also helps them age very well visually.
Yeah.
No matter what you think about the story, although I do think all of his movies have aged pretty well so far, just visually they're of such a classical style that there's nothing specifically 2008 about The Dark Knight, you know? So The Dark Knight still looks good today, you know? And I think that's something that he is wise enough to sort of want to stick with until, I mean, technology, maybe at some point, like digital technology would get good enough to just sort of have that timeless feel. I would imagine it will, but I do sort of wonder if maybe he sort of tones down the IMAX-ness of his movies after this. Like, it was all building to this, and then maybe he goes back to a story, to his wordier storytelling, but who the fuck knows with that guy. I do want to end talking about the actual movie, though, as opposed to formats, because I feel like there are some things that we haven't discussed, little things that I do enjoy, despite the bigness and the gut quality, or the gut punch quality of this movie, that I think is number one, the number one reason to like it. I think there are some little small things in it that I appreciate. I really love Mark Rylance's bit of performing when he says he's going to turn the boat to go get that downed pilot. And just the way he says, maybe he's alive, maybe, like, just such a like despaired, but, and knows how probably hopeless it is. But also, as we learn later, like, his son died early in the war in the Air Force. And I don't know, just that little moment paired with the moment that comes later, I just thought was really great. And it's a great piece of acting by Mark Rylance that then gets bolstered by the line later in the story by his son telling about his other son who died. I think that's fantastic. And also just all of the Cillian Murphy stuff, how it sort of shows, I mean, Nolan can't make a movie without some sort of ethical question, like, is it okay to lock Cillian Murphy in this room, you know? But just the way that this movie does touch on PTSD without actually leaving the war, I think is cool. And I don't know how I would feel about seeing a war movie like this that doesn't address PTSD in any way. I think it would change the whole structure of the movie, or the feel of the movie. And I think Mr. Dawson goes a long way in sort of adjusting how we feel about this movie after it ends, even though that's not something we're thinking about at the ending. Just the way that people are like, it's fine to Cillian Murphy, because they understand, like, he's not really a fully formed human being at that point. You know, he's been through so much trauma that he couldn't accept the idea that he killed this kid. So they lie to him to sort of at least allow him to continue on existing without who knows, you know?
Yeah, that's not what he needs right then. Yeah, I didn't know if, I mean, I assume you'd be won over by the rest of the movie. I didn't know how you'd feel about him, Peter, the kid telling him that he was okay, and then, you know, Mr. Dawson giving him the head nod. I didn't know if that might be a little too sincere for
no
you.
I like it because there's the line earlier when Peter says, no, he's not okay, and so there's this period in the middle where, without having a sit down with Mr. Dawson or his dad, with his dad being like, well, we have to be nice to him because he's been through a lot, U-boats are no joke, and all of these other things that you couldn't imagine Mark Rylance saying. But
yeah, instead we just have them picking up all these other people and witnessing horrors in the meantime, right?
Exactly. And just sort of in that small passage of time, he learns what his dad already knew, and I think that that's really cool. And the other small thing, just very quickly, all of the things Tom Hardy does with his eyes in this movie. Tom Hardy is such a fantastic actor. I don't even know how he can be so good with
face acting.
Not even face acting, just a portion of his face acting. Like, it's amazing. But like, he's so fantastic in this movie with having so little room to move, like literal room to move, because he's strapped in and so much of his face is covered. But in general, I just think he's fantastic in this movie, which shouldn't be news to anybody at this point. But the other thing I really liked is towards the end of the movie, Alex, Harry Styles' character, a name I can remember because it is my own, him sort of wondering why people are celebrating their return. I like that that element sort of got added in to the movie, because as you were talking about, you know, this is a movie about an unsuccessful battle, you know, and I liked that he felt kind of bad about it, and I think that sort of helps reframe his actions earlier in the movie, and the way that he kind of goes back and forth between only caring about self-preservation and despite the fact that he's been helped by Tommy when we get introduced to Alex early in the movie. I just think that reframes the emotional roller coaster he has been on through the past week, just because you sort of realize that he has this self-doubt in him, self-doubt and also doubt of the whole operation, just because he feels like they didn't succeed. And even after people are saying surviving is enough to him, he still feels bad about it. And I thought that was a really nice thing to have in the movie. You know?
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
he can't read Churchill's address himself because he just feels like it would be too embarrassing for him.
Yeah, yeah, just that the line, all we did is survive.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just speaking earlier, like what I was saying earlier about how, it's just the avoidance of death is so much of what this movie is. It's not necessarily the gore of death or how horrific it is. It's just being able to put it off for at least any other amount of time. And so to say all we did is survive, and to have the old wise British man that's not Christopher Nolan say that that's enough.
That's not Christopher Nolan, but is related to Christopher Nolan.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He was in The Dark Knight Rises as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, just that idea that's what it is. Like, this movie was about postpone. I'm not gonna say avoiding death, because none of us avoid death, but just that's what this was. This 90 minutes before this was an exercise in surviving, and that's all there is to it, you know. And you were successful in doing that, and that's the sum of what really they had left to do at Dunkirk, and what the film Dunkirk was.
Yeah. And the last thing I want to talk about is the last shot. Just because I'm curious to know what you think about, because you know this movie ends in Tommy reading Churchill's address, the classic Nolan monologue closer, but not with a monologue written by Nolan, yeah. Or I guess a monologue cherry picked by Christopher Nolan, you know. But just that the because I thought for sure when I was watching this movie that shot of Tom Hardy, his plane on fire, on the beach, the last shot we see of his plane, I thought for sure that was going to be the last shot of the movie, and it comes back to Tommy holding the paper. And I'm curious to know what you think about why it went back to Tommy, and I do not have an answer about it, because my thinking about why the plane shot would be the last in the movie, and my hope, I guess, because I think it's a fantastic shot, because it's just this emblem of... Even when this plane was out of gas, the human behind it was still willing to help preserve all of the lives that were below him, you know? And he never turned around despite the fact that he knew what he was doing would probably end up where he was. Yeah. And just, I think he really, Tom Hardy really represents the I think collective spirit that we're supposed to feel from these people, is that he didn't care about himself as much as he cared about the people on the beaches. And I just thought that the burning plane was like that thing that he had been residing in for this entire movie gave it everything it could, you know, just like he did. And I felt like that burning plane was more of a symbol, a good symbol to end on than coming back to the face of an individual. And I'm just curious to know what you thought about that.
Yeah. Also, that burning plane looked really cool.
Oh my God. So cool.
Yes, I think that everything you're saying about it was correct, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that that's just a really sweet shot. No, I think, I mean, Tommy is the name of that they would just use is a generic, like the generic British soldier, you know, the way that you might call a German Jerry or Fritz. Like, yeah. It's not a name. It's just, you know, just this just placeholder, just the standard for individuals' names. And as you said, you know, we start with him, we end with him. And because of the name Tommy, it just seems to embody Britain. You know, he just is the British identity. And I think that, as I'm sure you've come across in reading all these Nolan interviews, that Dunkirk looms pretty large in the British consciousness, you know, especially in the era immediately after it, but it still seems to stick around. You know, there's been several films made about Dunkirk. And I think the reason Christopher Nolan wanted to do this movie is just that that kind of still remains a fixture in the public mind. And it was just the way that so many of these people just are in it to survive. You know, that's all we're really seeing Tommy do. Tommy doesn't really do anything heroic. There's a few moments of people kind of showing concern for other people, but Tommy's not really one of them. He's just surviving. So
I mean, he does save Alex's life right at the beginning, the boat crushing scene. Isn't that him grabbing Alex?
Oh, maybe. Okay, yeah, that could be true.
But even that's like a one example, you know.
Yeah, and not putting himself at risk, I don't think, like the way that
yeah, that's true. It's not like he was swimming in to get Alex, you know. He was just reaching out.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that we have this image, and as you were saying, this very powerful image of Tom Hardy's character willing to sacrifice himself. You know, that plane is what got him there. He had been doing calculations on how much fuel he had. You know, when he switched to his reserve tank, he clearly knew he was rolling the dice on his survival here. There's a way that he could have saved himself, and maybe some people on his side were going to die as a result, but he definitely had several chances to save himself with some certainty, and he doesn't. And I think that there's this moment of sacrifice that he makes, and we see that burning plane. We see this image that kind of sums up the war. You know, it's their plane, it's on fire, so there's this destruction, there's this violence to it, but after all of that, we still have the people. And I think that that's what Tommy is. We just get this shot of him, you know, sitting on a train in Britain, reading a newspaper, the way that I imagine a lot of British citizens were doing at the time.
Just seeing him like that, in the way that so many other people likely would be living their lives at the time, I think just really drives home that message that he does represent that. And as much as Alex is you know, part of the same army, and you know, seen as the same, you know, force that that Tommy's on. That anger and that bitterness is not something that I think the British people see in themselves, and it's that that ability to kind of just deal with what happened and move on. And I think the Canadian and British identities line up in a lot of ways, and I think that we kind of see ourselves in the same way, that you just, as awful as that was part of it, you just put your head down and you continue on. And I think that's Nolan's way to pay tribute to the people involved. And just like the dedication says, it's to everybody affected by this war. You know, it's not just affected by what happened at Dunkirk, not necessarily the people there, but everybody in the country.
Yeah. All right. Well, now we begin the long 2 to 3 year process of waiting for a new Christopher Nolan movie. We are very lucky that he works relatively quickly as far as directors of his level, you know?
Like, that's true.
Yeah. QT really takes his time. At least Nolan works basically as fast as you could expect one of these directors to work. But thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. We will be filling time for the next 2 years while we wait for the new Nolan film. So check back for all of those episodes. All right. Thanks for listening.